Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of June 20th through 27th. This week we're joined by the author Jason Berry, whose new book, Render Unto Rome, was just published by Crown. The book looks at the finances of the church, both on the diocesan and also on the level of the Vatican. We began our conversation by talking about what happens when a parishioner puts money in the church collection.
Well, it might be helpful for people who have not read the book. You provide a helpful introduction to, you know, what happens when the money is put on the collection plate. Where it goes, some goes to the bishop, some goes to the Vatican. Maybe you can explain that.
Every bishop functions as a combination of tax collector and central banker. It's an odd and unique role, I would say. And the truth is we don't really know how the funds break down, because a given parish will pay anywhere from 5 to as much as 15% of its cathedraticum, which means basically the tax. The wealthier parishes pay more, and often the bishop will help a poorer parish by using funds from one of the wealthier ones, and I don't think many of them would complain about that. As Catholics, we believe in helping the poor. Where it gets complicated, though, is literally with the amount of money that is donated that never gets into the parish accounts. Michael Ryan, who's a former U.S. Postal Service superintendent who for years investigated the offices, the post offices, and pilfering, you know, how money disappeared, has studied this for years and estimates that somewhere in the range of $90 million a year is simply unaccounted for, mainly embezzlements. There's a staggering number of news reports that I read through that many now are posted on the Bishop Accountability website. And Ryan estimates that since 1965, the church has lost about $2 billion from embezzlements. That's about as much as the abuse crisis. The difference is we don't know how much the insurance has covered the retrieval of certain funds. Bottom line is the bishops could immediately see a boost in the church's finances if every parish was under a binding order from the USCCB to count the money at the end of the collections on Sunday, secure the bag with the money, and then recount the money when it is placed in the bank on Monday. That way there wouldn't be any removal of the so-called walking around money that many pastors, not all, but many have become accustomed to over the years. That would be, I think, a fail-safe reform and program that the church literally would profit from.
In terms of transparency, what is the situation at most dioceses? What kind of information do they provide?
Well, I would say fewer than a dozen dioceses have bona fide financial statements that have been adequately inspected by CPA firms. Of the 190 or so dioceses around the country, very few post financial statements that include parishes and their assets. Now, on one level, many bishops today are concerned about parishes being viewed as assets. Even the term seems almost antithetical to the way we think of a parish. And that is because, you know, they've lost so much money in these legal settlements. Nonetheless, the more transparent the financial statements, I think, the easier it is going to be for lay people to feel that they're giving money and the money's going to the right place. Now, in fairness to the bishops, many of them, I'm sure, are reluctant to have fully complete and transparent statements because they're saving the plaintiff lawyers a lot of work, you know, and getting discovery and finding about the assets. So a lot of it really depends on how well a diocese or archdiocese is managed in terms of respecting the youth protection charter that the bishops voted on and approved 9 years ago.
You look very closely at the sale of church property, particularly what happened in Boston following, you know, the revelations from the Boston Globe in 2002. Use that as kind of a case example of how these situations are handled. What happened there, and, you know, what lessons can we learn?
What happened in Boston is that then Archbishop O'Malley arrived in 2003 in the summer And before he was formally invested, he went to Rome. He met with Cardinal Angelo Sedano, the Secretary of State. He met as well with Cardinal Dario Castiglion Hoyos, who was the prefect of the Congregation for the Clergy. Congregation for the Clergy is the office that has to approve the liquidation of assets or property over a threshold of $5 million or $11.3 million, depending on the size of the diocese or archdiocese. And basically, they said to him in as many words, look, we can't give you money to solve your problem, which is he was facing huge settlements for 550 victims, but we will give you carte blanche to sell whatever you need to sell. And this is actually borne out in a document from a case that went to the Signatura, which I got a copy of, and someone translated from the Latin for me. So O'Malley came back and faced with a burning crisis of many of these abuse survivors, an outraged public, and a serious financial sinkhole bequeathed to him by Cardinal Law, who by then had left and was living in a convent in Maryland. He took the advice of Bishop Lennon, the number two in command, and started approving the sale of parishes. Now, to sell a parish, you have to suppress it, which means that the bishop literally takes title to the parish and he gets all the money, all the cash reserves. Some of these parishes had a lot of money, and those are the ones who really began protesting. And the vigil movement began with people sleeping in the pews. Peter Bure, a member of one of those churches, became politicized, I guess you could say, or radicalized by this experience, and organized the Council of Parishes and spent the next 7 years going back and forth to Rome, shepherding cases, appealing these decisions through the Congregation for the Clergy and the Signatura. And now there's been movement whereby they're starting to tell bishops, okay, if you close a church, you cannot relegate it to profane use. It must remain a sacred space. And of course, what that means is it's not a parish, so people can't go there every week the way they're accustomed to or every day. On the other hand, you can't sell it. So it puts the bishops between a rock and a hard place.
Now, we should talk about what is perhaps the newsiest part of your book, which is the case involving this Italian businessman who was jailed and indicted by the FBI. And he was working with an individual who's actually the nephew of Cardinal Sedano, who's the Secretary of State under John Paul II. Maybe you could explain this case and what light it sheds on the financial kind of action to the Vatican.
Right. Well, Raffaello Foglietti was a flim-flam man who came out of central casting. He shows up in New York 2002 and actually I believe it was 2003, and his arrival in New York and the founding of this company pretty much parallels a move that Cardinal Sedano made in Rome shortly after meeting with Archbishop O'Malley as he was, you know, beginning his tenure in Boston. Sedano installed as undersecretary of the Congregation for the Clergy Monsignor Giovanni Caru, who, among other things, was feeding information on churches being shuttered in the United States to Foglietti and his vice president. And Foglietti's vice president was Sedano's nephew, Andrea Sedano, a building engineer in Italy. There was a third man besides Caru and Andrea Sedano who was part of this scheme. It was really a rank profiteering scheme. This is a guy named Antonio Miniero, who worked, ironically, in the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints. This is almost like the gang that couldn't shoot straight, except they made $800,000 that Foglietti got from milking his own investors in the United States. Half of that money went through the Vatican Bank by the time Foglietti was indicted and the operation shut down. He went to prison in the United States, and the three men who were central to the scheme, Cardinal Sedano's nephew, Andrea, Miniero, working in the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints, and Caru, are all considered unindicted co-conspirators by the FBI.
We should note in the book you do provide a letter that was sent by Cardinal Sodano at some point, I guess after some of these articles started appearing in the National Catholic Reporter, raising questions about some of these dealings, saying that, you know, my nephew is not involved and should not be, his name should not be used. So you do provide that in your book.
Well, I do, and it's actually a letter that I sort of make sport of, because here is Cardinal Sodano writing to Raffaele Fulieri, and the reason he's writing him is because Joe Feuerhard of the National Catholic Reporter, who sadly has just died within the last month, wonderful man, dear friend, he was the editor and publisher most recently. Joe, as a reporter for NCR in Washington, did the first big story exposing the questionability of this enterprise. Sodano saw the article, or at least was briefed on it. So he writes to Fulieri saying, I'm distressed to read that you're telling people that your company has these connections to the Vatican. I don't understand how this can be. Well, the literature, the website, was literally advertising. The Fulieri company has ties with senior Vatican officials. We're sensitive to the church. We know what we're doing. I mean, they were, you know, greeted with all sorts of, you know, lavish, affectionate, you know, sort of social rituals by many of the cardinals and archbishops of the United States. So, you know, this was obviously an enterprise that people on both sides of the Atlantic were satisfied with. The problem was Fulieri went crazy. He started spending like a drunken soldier. Sailor, when you spend $62,000 to get a private plane to go from Los Angeles to Las Vegas, which, you know, a couple hundred, few hundred bucks, maybe $400 or $500 today, you know, with all the oil going up, but $62,000 for one flight, some of his investors got upset.
Now, as we discussed earlier, your book, Vows of Silence, dealt with the case of Father Maciel, which, of course, is kind of blown up in the last few years. You write in this book about how that can be kind of a look at it as an example of some of the problems with the way the church is set up, especially regards to financial matters. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, I approach the saga of Maciel as a financial story in this book because there were so many citations in some of the books in Spanish, particularly one book by an author in Madrid, Alfonso Torres, that this man had an incredible way of separating people from their money, especially wealthy widows. He managed to financially seduce hundreds and hundreds of the wealthiest people in Latin America, and then moved the whole operation to the United States and to Italy, and was a guy with the Midas touch. He was the greatest fundraiser of the modern church. We know now that he was not only abusing his own seminarians as far back as the 1940s and 50s, but by the 1980s, he had children by at least two different women from Mexico, and I've seen reports that there was a third. In any event, he had two natural sons and an adoptive son by a woman whose expenses he covered in Cuernavaca for many years, and he had another family, a paramour and a daughter, whom he later moved to Spain and supported them quite generously, all of this with money that had been donated to a religious charity, namely the Legion of Christ. And I do give the Pope good marks for taking over the Legion. It was done belatedly. But nothing like this has been done in centuries. And, you know, what's ironic is that here you have Benedict XVI, who, as Cardinal Ratzinger, was certainly well known for the way in which he treated many theologians, punishments, investigations, and the like. And now, as Pope, he really needs a kind of grand inquisitor, so to speak, to use Hans Kung's reference to Ratzinger. He needs someone like that. He really needs a prosecutor-in-chief to deal with the many abuses within the church. What he's done with the Legion, though, is fascinating. He has prodded them to start negotiating reparations or compensations with some of these victims. We don't know how that has turned out as of yet, but it does give me, you know, some hope that even though he is moving slowly as a reformer, at least in this respect, he's moving in the right direction. The real problem, Tim, is that the church does not have an adequate justice system. The Vatican tribunals are archaic. They're a remnant of past ages in which bishops and cardinals were essentially judge and jury. That doesn't work in the world since the French Revolution. It certainly doesn't work in our world today, where pluralism and democracy have certain expectations of justice. You know, St. Augustine said justice is that virtue that gives everyone his due. And we need a big dose of that in the church in order to reverse these terrible financial scandals. And I think, you know, to rejuvenate the priesthood and the laity as well.
Now, when we talk about the church finances, I mean, there's several different layers here. You've got the level of the, you know, your local parish, your bishop, and then you've got, you know, the Vatican Bank, the level of the Vatican, as you write about. Are there steps in any of those areas that the church could take, you know, beyond what they've already done to make the finances more transparent, things they aren't doing that are obvious? I mean, the embezzlement is one thing you mentioned, but are there others?
Yes. I think every diocese should post a fully audited financial statement. And that would go a long way toward, you know, putting the church on the road to transparency and disclosure. And there's no reason why the bishops can't do that. I think there's this assumption that's deeply embedded in the mores of the hierarchy that we have to do it our way because it's always been done that way. Well, we have an impatient world of people in the pews now who expect more. And I would give Cardinal O'Malley in Boston credit in that regard. The Boston financials are among the most transparent that are available. And I think the Pope, to his credit, made an important move by establishing an oversight board for the Vatican Bank. How far they go, and of course that had to do with international laws on money laundering. $30 million was impounded last fall. It has now just recently been released. There were two transactions in Rome. And at the time, the Financial Times reported that the Vatican Bank has been used almost as a sort of offshore bank by certain privileged investors and clients of the bank, and obviously that has to end. So, I think Benedict made the right move by establishing this oversight board. The real question is whether they will pull the Vatican Bank into line with the other international institutions. And I would say, too, that it shouldn't be off the books anymore. When the Holy See posts its financial statement, they should have a clear, bona fide, audited statement of the bank as well.
Now, maybe you can speak a little bit about, I mean, you're dealing with institutions here that, as you say, are not transparent. They're not open about the way they go about business. How did you approach that as a journalist, trying to really uncover what's going on?
With great trepidation. there's a surprising amount of material. There is a lot of documentation out there. Much of it has come to us, or at least got to me, because of all the litigation that's been done. Many of the plaintiff lawyers, have gotten financial profiles, disclosure documents, things like that. So I was able to access a good deal of that. And a surprising amount has also been reported. You know, the Allied Irish Bank, for example, which does a great deal of business in this country, was at the heart of the financial plan to resolve the $660 million settlements in Los Angeles. And the Archdiocese, when I finished the book, was still carrying a loan, I believe, of $175 million with the Allied Irish Bank. Well, one would wonder, why would any bank lend money to an archdiocese to pay off legal claims? I would argue that there's been a long history of it. I had an attorney in San Diego who told me that the speculation among many of the plaintiff attorneys was that the Vatican was sending money through the AIB to help the Los Angeles Archdiocese. I can't prove that, but enough people believed it so that when people kept telling me that, of course, I couldn't get any confirmation one way or another, but I felt that, you know, when people like that are willing to go on the record, we ought to raise the question.
Now, out of curiosity, do you donate money to the church? And if how do you go about it? Are there ways that you would recommend perhaps some of our listeners that they want to donate money in a way so the money is used in kind of a just way, as you say, this notion of just stewardship?
I do give money to the church. I give much more to Jesuit High School in New Orleans and to Georgetown University, the two institutions that educated me and sometimes probably wish they hadn't. I give on Sunday. I contribute modestly. I mean, I'm not a wealthy person. Few writers are. I guess what it really comes down to is whether people who decide to remain in the church are satisfied with the culture of passivity, of pray, pay, and obey. And I think in the long run, if enough people begin to forcefully ask questions, and if enough priests begin to adopt standards of accountability by insisting, for example, that the Sunday collection plate will be counted on the spot and put in the bank and counted in the way I outlined earlier in this interview, you know, something like that goes a long way toward building trust, especially when a pastor lets people know why he is doing it.
Now, finally, I'm interested. You began writing about the sexual abuse scandal long before it was a story. You know, 10 years before your book came out, 10 years before the story broke in the Boston Globe. Now it's become a kind of a fact of life for every Catholic. They know about this. They accept that it's happened. It might be difficult. When you were writing about, there were a lot of resistance, especially in the case of Maciel. There were a lot of people denouncing what you were writing as just total falsehoods. How did you deal with that? And do you feel like you're going to face something similar here in terms of, like, you're kind of on the outside making criticisms that maybe people don't want to hear right now?
Well, I've come to terms with the fact that a lot of people view me as a pariah. I live in New Orleans, which is a pretty tolerant city, and that helps a lot, believe me. The people who attacked me for the Maciel reporting were mainly the Legion of Christ members and the publicists for them. And interestingly, several of them have now formally apologized to me in the last year or so. And it's not something I ever expected, but frankly, I appreciated it. The reporting that I've done in these three books has never really been challenged. People can attack the messenger, but if the message is valid and well-grounded, I think the trend of history is always toward greater openness and light. I'm comfortable with the work I've done. I've done it honestly. I haven't tried to engage in ad hominem attacks or to go after people, but this is not easy territory either. That's why I love jazz music so much.
Well, Jason Berry, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. It's great to be with you.
We want to thank Jason Berry again for coming in to speak with us earlier this week. And again, his book is called Render Unto Rome, The Secret Life of Money in the Catholic Church. You can also check out his two earlier books on the Catholic Church. The first on the sexual abuse scandal called Lead Us Not Into Temptation. And then his book on Father Maciel, Vows of Silence. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.